Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Freeform, a world that just might work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Gary Gerstle. He's a professor of American history emeritus at University of Cambridge, England. And we're going to be talking about his new book, The Rise and Fall of the Neoliberal Order, America and the World in the Free Market Era. And you can learn more at Gary Gerstle, that's GaryGerstle.com. GaryGerstle.com. On Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on kpfk.org Thursdays at 3 p.m. Pacific. Streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on tunein.com. And podcasts are available anytime, anywhere. Apple Podcasts, Podomatic.com, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net. TerrenceMcNally.net. Many look back on an American golden age as lasting from the end of World War II through the early 1970s. And though these were not the best of times for people of color, women, or the environment, to name just a few exceptions, employment was solid and reliable, wealth was shared, the U.S. was leader of the world in many categories, and at the core of it all was the greatest middle class the world had ever seen. Though that may be a time MAGA folk look back on fondly, I would like to remind them that taxes were high, really high at times, and unions were strong. Through the ongoing tussle between industry, labor, and government came success and growth. And rooted in 1960s idealism, we were out to share the prosperity even more. Richard Nixon signed into law both the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. But some in finance and business were not happy with the direction things were taking. Two things happened in 1970 that I believe set us on a course that today's guest has examined in detail. Milton Friedman, in a New York Times op-ed, made his admonition that the sole purpose of corporate behavior was to enhance shareholder value. An attorney and soon-to-be Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell wrote the Powell Memo, advocating that business redefine its relationship to politics and government. And don't let anybody tell you that ideas don't matter. Both of those were just ideas, but both were adopted with a vengeance, ultimately laying waste to shared prosperity. While much in our culture has come to embody 1960s visions, I believe the 260s values that have fared the worst are caring for the planet and economic justice. Why? Follow the money. It is in the narrow and short-term financial interest of wealthy and powerful individuals, corporations, and industries to stall and prevent change in those areas. In addition, despite all the progress in social and cultural terms, we're also failing to fill another key 60s value, our sense of community. We lost it one technological innovation, one demographic trend, one geographic shift at a time. Perhaps we didn't notice the gradual loss, but the price we've paid for convenience and mobility is high. We need a rebirth of community, and that presents a huge challenge in a society where our pain, fear, and disappointment fuel tribalism instead. So today, we will talk about the rise and fall of the neoliberal order. Among many, neoliberal has become an epithet, a word spat out in a mix of anger and disgust, so basically wrong in its conception of the world and of society and of humanity. And that conception, I'll put in one brief sentence, the market matters most, and in it lie the only solutions to our problems. I believe the ascendance of that worldview was aided by a particular set of circumstances that allowed it to last longer than it should have, but also doomed it as circumstances have changed. For example, when climate-related natural disasters and mass shootings are near daily occurrences, or when inequality causes too much pain and robs too many of the opportunity to fully engage in their lives. Globalization was perhaps the key such circumstance, adding sales markets, financial markets, and labor markets. There were a lot of winners. The money in some countries that were offshoring jobs for cheaper labor, the money and the workers in others that were gaining global capital and industry. The pie of markets and labor kept growing, but there were losers, most of whom were not treated fairly or well. And there were other contributing factors, the still incomplete reckoning with racism beginning in the 60s, the Vietnam War, the rise of OPEC in the 70s, the fall of the Soviet Union at the end of the 80s, and the Iraq War among them. The market, unfettered, or more accurately, writing its own rules, cannot respond effectively to the most critical challenges we face. Crises that have either grown out of the distortion of our economy and our politics, or are unsolvable because of them. Inequality, climate change, an unhealthy relationship with the rest of nature, pandemics and public health, social and racial division and tribalism, crippled government and endangered democracy. We need to imagine a winning system that can reckon with these challenges. So a core question is, what is the best mix of government and business and philanthropy to confront our biggest crises? And en route to that question, some others worth asking. How did neoliberalism happen? What does Gerstle mean by the neoliberal order? What failed in order to create the openings for its emergence? What gap did it fill? Why was it able to triumph, given that, as I said, it seems doomed to fail when asked to foster widespread well-being? How and why did its dominance last as long as it did, and why did it crack up? Where are we now, and most challenging of all, what comes next? Steve Bannon has been very clear for years. People are going to rise up. A populist revolution is coming. Will it be an uprising of the left or the right? Gary Gerstle is the Paul Mellon Professor of American History Emeritus and Paul Mellon Director of Research at the University of Cambridge in the UK. He's a Guardian columnist and has also written for The Atlantic, The New Statesman, Dissent, and The Nation, among others. He's the author and editor of more than 10 books, including two prize winners, American Crucible and Liberty and Coercion, and his latest, The Rise and Fall of the Neoliberal Order. Welcome, Gary Gerstle, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Wednesday, August 10th.
Terrence, thank you for that wonderful introduction, and it's very good to be with you.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about, because you tell us a bit about how you see your path to the work you do and what drives you today. And feel free to go way back and mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Well, I'm a historian of the United States and have been practicing this craft for 40 years now. Born in Cincinnati, Ohio, spent a lot of time in New Jersey, New England, Nashville, Tennessee, and have spent the last 10 years in the UK, most of that teaching at the University of Cambridge. I think it's fair to say that I was part of a revolution in history writing that occurred in the 1970s and 80s. When I was an undergraduate and then went to graduate school, history of America and other places was mostly a history of leaders, diplomats, wars, winners, and a lot of people were left out of that history. And I was part of a movement to write those people who had been left out of American history back into the story. It was called Social History, and it was a history from the bottom up rather than the top down. And it has had an enormous impact on the writing and teaching of American history and on the perceptions of America in popular consciousness. So this was a movement that led to an unprecedented degree of African-American history, history of women, history of labor, history of indigenous peoples. And we now have a much richer tableau of the panorama that is America. And I have been a part of that for my entire career. My initial interest was in labor history. I grew up without a sense that America had any kind of vibrant labor movement at all. This was not something that we learned or something that was taught. And I was part of a group of self-styled new labor historians who were going to recover a history that had been left out. And my early focus was on the 1930s and the labor uprisings of those years and the forces from below that helped to make what I called in a 1989 book the New Deal order. Mm-hmm. Class life in America was never as straightforward as we might like it to have been. Race was an enormously complicating factor, so was nationalism. So I set off on a voyage that lasted 10 or 20 years to think about race, immigration, and American nationhood. That became the substance of my book, American Crucible, Race and Nation in the 20th Century. But I always wanted at some point to get back to questions of political economy, wealth distribution, and how it influenced politics. And I think if we look for the origins of my current book, the origins lie in 2016. I was an American living in Britain. In 2016, living and working in Britain, I first went through the shock of Brexit, and then I went through the shock of Trump's election. Both those events were unimaginable to anybody in Britain or the United States 20 years earlier. And I thought, how can I explain Trump? How can I explain Brexit? My book is not about Brexit, but it does situate Trump in an international context of a certain political order that had had enormous prestige, even hegemony. And I saw then, and I still see today, Trump's rise, not just Trump's rise, but Bernie Sanders' rise and the reawakening of an American left. I see that as a sign of the breakup of a political order that had been extraordinarily powerful and that had constrained political choice. And my book, The Rise and Fall of the Neoliberal Order, became a comprehensive history of how that political order emerged, how it gained enormous power, and then its spectacular crack up in the second decade of the 20th century, leaving us at the current moment in a very uncertain and volatile place. I had, fortunately, at hand a framework for understanding the rise and fall of neoliberalism because the book I had published in 1989 with Steve Fraser, The Rise and Fall of the New Deal Order, introduced the concept of political order into a discussion of politics. We can talk more about that if you wish. I decided in the book I've just published to apply that concept of political order to the story of neoliberalism, and that's probably one of the distinctive contributions of the book we're discussing today. So that gives you a bit of background about me. I should also add it's been a really interesting and fascinating experience to be an American teaching American history outside the United States. That in itself has been an education. I had a 30-year career as an academic in the United States and have really valued the last 10 years for the broadening effect that it has had on my historical thinking and writing.
Let's talk about that for just a second, Gary, because it puts you in a fairly unique, a fairly small field there. How did you end up after, as you say, decades of teaching history and studying history in the U.S., how did you end up in the U.K.? And then what are some of the perspectives that you've seen?
I first went to Oxford as a visiting professor in 2012, 2013, and then came back to Vanderbilt University for a year where I was teaching at the time, and a job came up at the University of Cambridge. I was offered the job and decided to go. I think if we're to understand why I did this, my wife is also a historian. Her name is Elizabeth Lumbeck. When we were undergraduates, we didn't know each other then. We both spent a year in England. I was studying at the London School of Economics, and she was into African studies at that point. For both of us, I think, having not come from intellectual families, this constituted a year of intellectual awakening. I had gone to learn from the British labor historians of great accomplishment, E.P. Thompson, Eric Hobsbawm, and others, and to bring that knowledge back to the study of American labor history. That was my reason for going over. But there was something about the experience of being in Britain and doing intellectual work and having ideas bandied about and talked about in the public square in ways we did not experience in the United States that we found very stimulating and exciting. And we used to talk often about, you know, spending part of our careers there, but we had a family, two children, 2 years. We're not always in command of our lives, right? And then then the kids grew up, and suddenly I had a kind of freedom to move. Serendipitously, I was offered this job at the University of Cambridge. I think it's good in the latter stages of one's career to try something new, no matter how much you love something. If you do it for 30 years, it can get to be routine. I thought that situating myself as a professor of American history in a foreign country and teaching American history to mostly British students and to graduate students from all over the place would be an interesting and challenging project and would educate me. And for me, place where I've lived and been located has always informed the kind of history that I've done. I spent 8 years in Nashville, Tennessee, and that informed my previous book, which was to take criticisms of central government power seriously in ways I had not done before. I thought and believed that writing and thinking about American history in Britain would freshen me up and give me new perspectives on the United States. And I think that has been the case. So I'm very grateful for having had this opportunity.
It sounds like you said a couple of things there. One is that the square, if you will, the place where people talk about things, the kinds of conversation people have in the UK are different from here. How? Deeper? More likely, no matter what class or education status? What sort of things?
Well, I think they're probably less different today than they were 50 years ago.
Sure, or sure.
When I was in the UK, how old was I then? I was, like, I guess, around 19 or 20 years old. You know, there was not this kind of podcast that we're doing today. There were only a few television stations, as you certainly remember. Radio was more expansive, but still limited before the cable revolution, before the digital revolution, which has greatly expanded the public square that we all participate in, for good and for ill. But
yes.
I think what came into focus for me is the quite deep anti-intellectualism of American life, in the sense that intellectuals are often looked on with suspicion. They are thought to need to be kept away from politics. They're not practical. They dream dreams that can't be, and if implemented, would do people a lot of harm. America has always had this populist thread, and I don't use that entirely in a negative way, but the idea that ordinary people should be in charge, and there's a sense in America that people who have spent too much time studying and thinking in universities and other places have perhaps lost touch with the people and thus should be looked on with suspicion. So what I encountered in Britain was a much closer connection between the sphere of intellectuals and the sphere of politics. And I found that very exciting, the exchange between the two realms. And also, Britain then and still today has a clear and proud history of a working class that takes pride in itself and what it is. It has a Labour Party, after all, although it's not clear how much of a Labour Party it still is.
It still has the name.
It still has the name. I thought also that I encountered ideas that were part of public discussion in ways that were not possible in the United States. So keep in mind, when I was at the London School of Economics in 1974, 75, this was still the height of the Cold War. Despite the opening to China, the U.S. was still undergoing the trauma of Vietnam. Anti-communism was a core element of Americanism, and that shut down the possibility of talking about all sorts of ideas that one perhaps wanted to talk about, even though the New Left was in the process of loosening a lot of things up. And so I found the political spectrum in Britain to be broader, more expansive, freer in some ways, and I found that very stimulating. I learned a lot from it.
Let me ask you something about your chosen field. It turns out another recent interview I did, as I was preparing for this one, I realized how resonant they both were, was in Michael Kazin, history professor at Georgetown, who's written a history of the Democratic Party. And obviously the overlap of sections of your book and what you're focusing on and what he was focusing on, when you think about it today, looking back, looking forward, what is the role of history? Is this just for fellow academicians and young students who are going to follow in your footsteps? Or does the study of history and the writing about history have something to offer everyone?
I think it has something to offer everyone. Let me just say parenthetically that Michael Kazin and I are good friends and have been since 1984 when we first met at a labor history conference. And if you look at the acknowledgments in both our books that have just been published, you will see profuse thanks. You know, we have been engaged intellectually with each other for nearly 40 years, and it's been a very productive and exciting intellectual relationship. And I think we've also, in some ways, followed different paths, and as we've exchanged ideas and developed and evolved over the course of our careers. As to what history has to offer, think of the 1619 Project. Very controversial, but think of the influence it has had on Americans' perception of their past. Whether one locates the beginnings of America in 1619 or 1776, it is no longer possible for people in public life to ignore the centrality of slavery to American history. That was not the case when I started out. When I started out, immigration history was not a very vigorous field. And when I was taught American history as an undergraduate in high school, I learned almost nothing about nearly 80 million immigrants coming to America over the last two centuries. We knew more about Native Americans, of course, chiefly because of the Western, and also because I'm using these in quote marks, the red man was regarded as a, quote marks, savage but honorable foe against which Americans defined their nationhood. Theodore Roosevelt, who I've written extensively about, thought that Native Americans had to be exterminated ultimately, but he thought also that the struggle against them was absolutely essential to define American nationhood on the frontier and make a warrior-like people and give them the space to develop democracy. So we knew more about indigenous peoples, but it was all stereotypical. It was all from John Ford Westerns.
Sure.
And we grew up on the tremendous popularity of the Western in the 1950s and 60s, but no real consciousness of what the lives of indigenous peoples were like, the variety of tribes, the story of warfare, settler colonialism, expansion, that the process of white settling the North American continent entailed. And if you just think of the baseball teams that have changed their names.
Yes.
In the Cleveland Indians are gone. The Washington Redskins are gone. The Atlanta Braves are still with us, but perhaps time bound. Changing these names in the 1970s and 80s was unimaginable. You just couldn't imagine it. You would have been on the small fringe of some group to suggest.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Some little crazy group. It would be something you'd point out as why there are people who even think that, you know, that sort of thing.
That had to happen. Now, it sometimes takes a long time for ideas present in the academy to be diffused through broader public consciousness. And I think of the work on slavery and indigenous Americans and American women and American workers. It's been going on for decades. And I would say only in the last 10 or 15 years have issues that scholars have been studying and the knowledge that's been accumulating really penetrated popular consciousness. It's not automatic that what's being done by scholars is going to make a difference in the public square, but this is not easy work. It's not easy work to do the research. And it's also not easy for a country schooled in one way of believing for itself to think that it really was in some respects very different than they had been taught. And that's part of what we're living through now. It's part of what the furious culture wars are about.
One thing that I think is core to this book is just what the notion of an order, a political order, is. And you also use the term hegemony. For folks who don't think in those terms, what do you mean when you talk about an order or hegemony?
Many of the people who were doing this history were working without really much public recognition for years and sometimes decades. But in the last 10 or 15 years, the entry into the public realm has been very impressive, and it has made a big difference in terms of how people think about America. These are not easy times, because if you've grown up with one image of America and suddenly you're confronted with data, evidence, interpretations that force you to think in different ways about the country you grew up in, it's not always easy to accept, nor should it be automatically accepted. Once these ideas are thrust into the public sphere, they should be debated, discussed. And if the U.S. is to move to a different understanding of itself, it's inevitably going to be a bumpy process, not an easy one. And we are in the midst of one of those transitions right now, which is one reason why the culture wars of the current moment are so furious. Part of what's being debated is what kind of country is America, where has it been, and where is it going? And a lot of that is informed by the scholarship that writers, scholars, historians have done over the last three decades.
Yeah, yeah. I also think another reason that we're engaged in such culture wars are because the party that fans the flame of those culture wars has little else on offer, but that strategy wouldn't work if they weren't tapping something that is real and taking place in homes and families and so on. Let me ask you what you mean when you talk about the neoliberal order or the New Deal order. What do you mean by a political or economic order? And you also use the word hegemony, and I think they're kind of related. What does that mean to you?
Well, so much discussion of American politics revolves around 2, 4, and 6 year political cycles. The concept of political order looks at how certain tendencies in American politics come to be dominant in American politics over longer stretches of time, 30 or 40 years. It's an effort to break with our preoccupation with 2, 4, and 6 year election cycles. Of course, we have to pay attention to the next president. Of course, we have to pay attention to the midterms coming up in November 2022. But there are also changes that develop over longer periods of time and then hold their power and influence for a longer period of time. Some presidents are more important than others. Some congresses and presidents leave more of a legacy and more of an imprint on American life than others. And the concept of political order is an effort to understand how certain political movements become something more than simply political movements. They acquire the ability to order the terrain on which American politics is fought. What do I mean by that? Let's use the example of the New Deal in the 1930s associated with FDR and the Democratic Party. They had a core idea that capitalism left to its own devices would self-destruct, generate too much chaos, generate too many casualties, human casualties. And so the only way forward was to manage the economy in the public interest. And it was the job of the federal government to do that. When that idea was first floated, it was deeply contentious. The Republican Party thought it was abhorrent. And then Roosevelt began winning elections, not just 32, but 36, 40, and 44. And then Truman, his successor, won. Republicans were out of office from 1932 to 1952 until Dwight D. Eisenhower won. And during that time, the new, what had been a movement became something more. It became a coalition of constituencies, think tanks, media platforms, core ideas, visions of the good life, all of which cohered in one way or another to make the New Deal into something more than simply a political movement, made it into the dominant force in American life politically. So much so that if Republicans wanted to get back into office, they had to subscribe or acquiesce to the core ideas of the New Deal. And this is what makes Dwight D. Eisenhower such an important president in 1952. In the mid to late 40s, he was not favored. People weren't even sure he was a Republican. Half the people thought he was a Democrat. And the favored son of the Republican Party was a senator from Ohio named Robert Taft. And he wanted to dismantle the entire New Deal. He wanted to dismantle a big central government. He wanted to roll back high taxes. He wanted to return power to the states and return the federal government to the diminutive stature it held in the 19th century. And he was very popular until the Cold War broke out and until the global fight of communism made a large central government able to fight communism everywhere and able to deliver the good life to most Americans, not just wealthy Americans. And Eisenhower began to gain in stature because he was perceived as the candidate who would give Americans something new. 20 years of democratic rule was quite enough, thank you. But he would subscribe to the core ideas of the New Deal. And thus, he did not try and dismantle the large central state. He expanded Social Security rather than restrict it. He did not try to dismantle the power of labor unions, which was a transformative moment in the 1930s and 40s. He respected the right of all workers to join unions and the obligation of all employers to bargain with them collectively. And he did something even more stunning than that when he was reworking the tax code in 1953 and 54. What was he going to do about the highest tax rate on the highest marginal group in America? It was at that point 91%. You would think any Republican in good standing would lower that somewhere below 50% and preferably somewhere below 40 or 30%. Eisenhower keeps it at the astounding level of 91%. This is unimaginable for the Republican Party today. If you proposed that in the Republican Party today, you would be kicked out of the party right away. What is going on here in the larger sense? Eisenhower is leading the Republican Party to acquiesce to the core principles of the New Deal. Whether he believed this in his heart or whether he felt he had to do it, he writes his brother at one point in a private letter. He said any Republican candidate who would get rid of Social Security, the power of organized labor, lower taxes to their pre-New Deal level, would not have a chance at re-election. This is what he believed. And so this, to me, demonstrates that the New Deal had gone from being a political movement to a political order. In the 1980s, Reagan was the architect of the neoliberal order. There, as you stated in your eloquent introduction, the core idea was just the opposite of what it had been in the 1930s. Government screwed up the economy to release the economy to do what it could. You had to free up markets from government restraint. And he unveiled a series of programs to do just that. When Bill Clinton becomes president, and there had not been a Democratic president in 12 years, and except for the Carter interregnum, even longer than that, what's he going to do? Is he going to take down the neoliberal movement that Reagan had put in place, or was he going to acquiesce to it? And lo and behold, he does quite a lot to bring along the Democratic Party to acquiesce to the core principles of neoliberalism. The era of big government is over. Deregulate finance, deregulate telecommunications, support or endorse the Reagan deregulation of mass communications. He deregulates in multiple different areas, and thus he plays a role in leading the Democratic Party to acquiesce to the core neoliberal principles of Reagan's Republican Party in the 1980s. And I call him the Democratic Eisenhower.
Yes, of course.
Because his role is quite similar to Eisenhower in the 1950s. And again, it's a question not necessarily of what Clinton believed in his heart, but what he felt compelled to do in order for the Democratic Party to have success. And this is where the word hegemony comes into play. Hegemony is a word launched by the Italian thinker Antonio Gramsci, and it was meant to connote a set of ideas so powerful that they structure the entire landscape of political possibility. Clinton came to the conclusion in the 1990s that the only way forward for him, the Democrats, to be a successful party was to find a place within this hegemonic force. Could not get out of it and be a relevant player in American politics. To get out of it would make you like Bernie Sanders. And in the 1990s, he was utterly irrelevant in American politics. And Clinton, in a sense, was saying, we can't go there. We have to play by Republican rules. That's a sign that there's a hegemonic force in play, that individuals cannot just say whatever they want to in politics and win elections, that they have to play on the playing field that's been structured for them by an opposition party whose ideas have been able to structure that space and condition what can be said for those seeking success in American politics.
Yes, absolutely. So let me tell people, by the way, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Gary Gerstle. He's professor of American history emeritus at the University of Cambridge, England. And we're talking about his new book, The Rise and Fall of the Neoliberal Order, America and the World in the Free Market Era. You can learn more at Gary Gerstle, GaryGerstle. One word, GaryGerstle.com. And your Twitter handle is GL Gerstle, at GLGERSTLE. It's interesting, before you said it, I was going to say, yes, of course, Clinton sounds like the Democratic Eisenhower. I was also just going to add to that, which I assume you agree with me, that Eisenhower took that path. And Nixon certainly followed it. As I pointed out, it was under Nixon that we got EPA and OSHA, about as unlikely with today's Republicans as a 91% tax bracket. One thing that I think is different about Clinton and Eisenhower is Eisenhower, I sense, saw this from the start. Perhaps when you're used to commanding to win wars, you have to see the big picture. But Clinton tried the first time, as you've pointed out, to be and do differently. As you point out, Robert Reich, Joseph Stiglitz were key advisors. They are certainly on the left, but his health care failure, and then, if I'm not mistaken, because he had to raise taxes so much to make up for the deficits that Bush the father had left him with, I think it was 43 Democratic congresspeople lost races in the midterms, and that's when he adopted the neoliberal principles. Do you agree?
Yes, yes. Now, Clinton was always a pragmatic politician.
Oh my, yes. I'd say opportunistic, perhaps, but
I'm going to be more neutral than that.
Yes.
You can agree to disagree.
Yes.
He comes from Arkansas, a very conservative southern state, and early in his career, he was elected and then defeated. That really stung, and that was a lesson to him about having to make certain adjustments that he might not like to make for the sake of continuing his political career. And in 1992-93, the election, and then him assuming office in 1993, he came in with some big plans, none bigger than quite a radical overhaul of the national health care system, putting in place a system of national health insurance, largely paid for by the federal government, more radical than what later became Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't handle it well, and it was a very complex bill, and the Republicans hated him. They hated him even before he came into office and did everything they could to make his and Hillary's life hell. So they had real enemies really from the start of his presidency. And part of the Republican anger was a sense among Republicans that this should have been their hour. But for Ross Perot's entry into the 1992 presidential campaign, and I believe he got 19% of the vote, that George H.W. Bush would have been reelected president of the United States. Clinton got about 43% of the vote. He won by plurality. He was the legitimate president. But the Republicans were feeling their power and everything they had done during the Reagan years, bringing down the Soviet Union. And so they felt that something had been robbed from them.
Mm-hmm.
And Clinton was also the first of the presidents to have an affiliation with the New Left generation, and he hippie, pot smoking, all the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big transition in American life. So they were out to get him, and the mishandling of the health care bill gave them their opportunity. And then Clinton suffers a shattering defeat in the 1994 midterms, the worst defeat of a sitting president since Harry Truman in 1946. Let me repeat that.
Mm-hmm.
The worst defeat for a Democratic president since 1946. Losing both houses of Congress, this marked the emergence of Newt Gingrich, new Speaker of the House, onto the American political scene, and a new style of very aggressive Republican politics, culture war style, take no prisoners, very, very combative. And Clinton then decides that the only way for him to survive and for the Democratic Party to survive is to triangulate, which was to take a Republican position, gauge the Democratic distance from it, and move the Democratic position to a point on the triangle where it might be acceptable to Democrats. This is a story of acquiescence. This is when he decides, for the sake of political survival, he has to pursue a different course. And so the policies that Clinton had embraced are mostly subsequent to 1994, but not all. And one of the ones that preceded that was NAFTA. Now, NAFTA was not his design, making the North America region continent a free trade zone. It had emerged from George H.W. Bush negotiations, but he embraced it as the only way forward for America and a globalizing world. And we're beginning to get evidence now that some of the hemorrhaging of support among white working class Americans dates from a sense of betrayal over NAFTA when it was being endorsed by Clinton in 1993. And as more people study the 1990s now, we're getting a sense that NAFTA may have figured into this more than we had previously thought. But nevertheless, most of the deregulating work that Clinton is going to do, most of the embrace of the market and globalization, happens after the 1994 midterms, 1995 onward, really to the waning days of his presidency. So this is an adjustment he makes for the sake of political survival, doing what he can to pursue democratic goals, but in the larger scheme of things, acquiescing to core Republican Party principles, which had the effect of making the Republicans even more furious with him.
Because right, he's stealing our act.
We should be implementing these acts, not him. And that didn't incline them to say, oh, we have a friend in the White House. That inclined them to say, oh my goodness, this is outrageous.
Yeah.
We have to bring this man down and expel him from the White House in any way we can, including through an impeachment process.
That's right. That's right. And I do think, by the way, and you, I've heard you say it as well, is that Hillary Clinton started out her career as their hated. You know, the hate from Arkansas came to Washington. And then I felt that if Trump had two claims against her, one was NAFTA and the other was, you've been in Washington for 30 years. Why should we expect anything to change now? And so I do think you're right. I think NAFTA was an enormous anchor on her in the states that were crucial and the states she lost. What I want to do right now, though, is jump back because I think your contextualization of why neoliberalism takes hold, the fractures of the 70s that make it possible and ascendant, is worth reminding people. And so I'd love you to do that, if you will.
Well, let me preface that by saying a serious fissure in the New Deal order that emerges in the 1960s through the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
Any political order is not a perfectly functioning machine. It's any political party in America is large, varied, has to serve a lot of different interests. There are always fault lines and fracture lines. And one of the things that the New Deal order did very poorly in its early years was to address issues of African-American equality. Roosevelt didn't want to touch that issue in most instances because he was dependent on white Democrats in the South to get through all his major programs of political economy to erect a strong state to manage capitalism in the public interest. And the white Democrats in the South, who came out of a populist heritage, said to Roosevelt, we will go along with you as long as you don't interfere with the racial and class hierarchies of the South. And what did that mean? It meant leaving Jim Crow untouched. And so the New Deal left Jim Crow untouched, but it could only do so for so long because the egalitarianism of the New Deal movement and of its ideology spoke about the importance of making all Americans equal, irrespective of their race, religion, creed, or anything else. And the civil rights movement gathered steam in the 50s and early 60s, so much so that a Southern Democratic president in the form of Lyndon Baines Johnson can no longer ignore the issue. In order to pass the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65, absolutely critical pieces of legislation for America to surmount its odious history of segregation and Jim Crow, he had a break with the white South, the white Democratic South. And that was the moment when the Democratic Party lost what had been a very important constituency. And Johnson understood that this was going to put the future of the Democratic Party in peril, but he felt it was something that absolutely had to go forward. And he went forward with it. And so race begins to convulse the Democratic Party in ways it had not in the 1930s. And this becomes an internal issue within the Democratic Party in the 1960s, continuing into the 1970s. So that becomes a problem for the authority and the hegemony of the New Deal order. And then in the 1970s, the circumstances of the world economy change quite dramatically. And it happens in two ways. First, after World War II, the United States was the only industrial power in the world left standing with its industrial plant intact. UK's plant had been devastated, France's, Germany's, Italy's, Belgium's, Japan. From the mid-40s to the mid to late 60s, the world was the oyster of American corporations. They could go anywhere, do anything. They had no serious international competition. But the U.S., in order to generate markets for its exports, has to build up the economies that have been destroyed, Britain, France, Germany, Japan, and they have new equipment, new technology, new machinery, industrial relations that are frequently functioning better than what's functioning in America. And by the late 60s and early 70s, they have become serious competitors to the United States once again, nowhere more clearly than in automobile manufacture. Mm-hmm. In the late 60s and early 70s, German cars and Japanese cars begin entering the United States in very large numbers. And that has effects not just on the automobile industry, but of course, the steel industry and all the other ingredients that go into making these very complex and expensive machines. The other big change in the 1970s is alteration in the relationship between the global North and the global South. The global North had seen the restoration of its prosperity based on cheap energy, mostly petroleum. And this cheap energy was coming largely from the Middle East, from Saudi Arabia, from Iraq, from Iran. And most of this oil drilling and shipping and pricing and the volume that was being taken out of the ground was controlled by Anglo-American petroleum companies that had dominated the business since the early years of the 20th century. And this is the moment of OPEC's formation, when Saudi Arabia says, these resources do not belong to the global North, they belong to us, and we are going to organize ourselves and other oil producers into a cartel, and we will determine the amount of oil extracted and the price at which it will sell. And they shut down some of the oil that's being produced, they dramatically increase the price, and they plunge the global North into a very severe economic recession. When the economic formulas that have been developed in the New Deal years, largely beholden to Keynesian economics, are no longer working anymore. And the economic managers working for the federal government can no longer get the economy under control. They cannot restore it to prosperity. Inflation is rampant. And also unemployment is rising, different from today, when unemployment is very low and inflation is very high. In the 1970s, inflation was very high and unemployment was rising. And those two things are not supposed to move together. They're supposed to move in opposite directions. So it befuddled economic policymakers who had been managing the economy quite well. And these dramatic changes in the global economy coming on the heels of the divisions arising from civil rights break apart the New Deal order and undermine the authority of the Democratic Party, puncture its hegemony. And moments in which hegemony is punctured are very interesting, because ideas that have been consigned to the sidelines for many years suddenly have a chance to enter the mainstream. And the neoliberal ideas of the 1970s are not new. Some of the architects of those ideas, Hayek, have been talking about them since the 1940s, Milton mm-hmm. Friedman since the 1950s. They had supporters all over the place, but they were utterly irrelevant to American politics, without power and without a chance of gaining power. And in the crisis of the 1970s, they get their chance. And because they have been very skillful about planning their ascent, refining their ideologies, developing policies, networking, establishing think tanks, finding donors, finding a good candidate who could lead them. Ronald Reagan himself had been talking about these neoliberal ideas since the early 50s. We have an image of him as a dumb man who couldn't do anything but act and not be a very good actor at that. Well, he was reading Hayek, not an easy man to read, on train rides between GE plants in the early 50s, where he was going from one GE plant to another to give talks trumpeting the virtues of free enterprise. This is a man who regarded the New Deal as a way station toward communism, state socialism, and the destruction of American liberty. He had been spreading and advocating these ideas for 30 years or 25 years. He had had experience as governor of California, not an easy state to manage at any time, but certainly not in the 1960s. So he was a much more skillful politician and much more deeply committed to principles than many, myself included, understood at the time. And so these insurgents who have been waiting for this kind of moment move very quickly to implement neoliberal policies into politics. One general comment, very brief, to add to that is that economic crises are usually moments when existing political orders crash and mm-hmm. new ones get a chance to bid for influence and power. And the 1970s was one such moment.
I want to get to the why you see the fall of the neoliberal order. So I'm going to very quickly go over Obama. One could have said, based on just what you said a moment ago, that economic disorder often leads to the breakup of political order, and that the crash of 2008 could have led to a shift at the time, But in fact, Obama stayed with the neoliberal playbook and the separation between the way Wall Street was treated and the way Main Street was ignored, in some sense, sows the seeds for the 2016, if you will, assault on the neoliberal order. Pick up why the neoliberal order falls apart.
Well, the neoliberal order was based on a fiction, which you alluded to in your introductory remarks, that if you freed capitalism from its constraints, if you encouraged all markets to develop and did that on a global scale, that all boats would rise. Yes, you might have increasing inequality, but that would be a small price to pay for everybody getting more and seeing their life circumstances improved. This was the selling point of neoliberalism in the 1990s and first decade of the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. Just let the markets do their work. And we end up with the crash of 2008-2009, followed by a brutally inequitable recovery.
The crisis was deep. The world's entire financial system almost collapsed. A moment of danger as great, I think, as the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, although this was not nuclear Armageddon, but financial Armageddon. We shouldn't underestimate the challenge confronting Obama, who saw all the details on the near meltdown of the entire financial system of the world. And he proceeds cautiously, which is in line with his temperament, and
yes,
he decides that his first priority has to be to restore the integrity of the banks and restore them to health. And then he will take care of Main Street. And so the legislation of early 2009, spreading into the summer, of saving the banks, goes much further than the work done to help Main Street ordinary Americans who've lost jobs, lost homes because they can no longer afford the mortgages. And the result of that is that the pain and suffering of the Great Recession is spread very unevenly through the population. By 2010, 2011, the stock market has regained much of its earlier value. And thus, if you're invested in the stock market, you're no longer worried about this great crash in American life. But employment doesn't return to old levels until after 2016, 2017, 2018. Wages are stagnating. And people have lost wealth, they've lost homes. And this generates a lot of anger. And the result of the crash of 2008-2009, this was the moment when neoliberal hegemony gets punctured and the air is let out of that balloon. And as often happens in a big economic crisis, the new ideas for building new orders don't appear right away. It takes time. And it took time for the new ideas to appear over the course of the second decade of the 20th century. But what was so striking about the election of 2016, the two most dynamic players in that election, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, were regarded in the 1990s as political losers, no chance in American politics. If they had thrown their hat into the ring beyond Vermont or Trump with the presidency in those years, they would have been laughed at. And suddenly these are the two most dynamic players in American politics. And they both break in basic ways with key neoliberal ideas. They do it in somewhat different ways, but they both break with neoliberal principles. They convulse American politics. Sanders is both a product of a reborn left in American politics, and he's an energizer of that left at the same time. And so he is the spokesperson for a left in American politics, stronger and with more influence than any time since the 1930s and 40s. And Trump, who doesn't really have a clear idea of what he wants to do other than to increase his power, his wealth, and his adulation, begins to fashion what I call an authoritarian ethno-nationalist order. Very little familiarity or respect for democratic notions of governance, really knows nothing about the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution, talks about America as Washington being a swamp. Perhaps it would be better if Congress were to be destroyed. Vests power in him. He can act decisively in ways that the messy process of compromise and deliberation could never work in a Congress that seemed paralyzed most of the time. Let the great leader lead America out of its abyss. Vest all power unto him, and he will take care of the people. But the people, in his telling, were a certain kind of people. They were all people of European descent. He believed and still believes very strongly that America ought to be the home of people of European descent and not people of color. And so he begins to construct an alternative future for America grounded in authoritarian and ethno-nationalist principles. Biden's victory in 2020 is a big setback for him and authoritarians and other places in the world. The rise of authoritarianism is not, as I think we all know, an American phenomenon, but an international phenomenon. And there was promise in Biden's election, and we shouldn't underestimate the significance of his win, not just the number of votes he got, but the way in which he entered into dialogue with Bernie Sanders and the left of the Democratic Party. I would argue that the Democratic Party has been most significant when there's been productive conversation between the center and left of the party, and Biden and Sanders engaged in that conversation. The first 6 months of the Biden presidency were very hopeful, the next 6 months very dejected, and now we seem to be moving into a third phase. But if we are to catch the spirit of the moment, we really don't know what's going to come next, whether it will be a new progressive order that abandons neoliberal principles, whether it will be a Trump-led authoritarian order, or whether America will be consigned to living in circumstances of disorder for an extended period of time. And I think disorder describes our current condition at this moment.
Interesting. I think we've got to close it there, which is a hell of a place to close it. But the book is The Rise and Fall of the Neoliberal Order. As you can tell from listening to what we've said here, Gary Gerstle really goes into these threads, these movements, these things in a deep and thoughtful way. I asked him early in the conversation about the value of history or the work of historians, but I do think since we are at a point where we can see the neoliberal order is crashing, is not a winning formula, and we can feel that tussle, that it is worth knowing where we've come from and how things have evolved in the past and how things have changed in the recent past as a way of, as a helpful way of looking at and helping influence where we go from here. The website is garygerstle.com. Gary, G-A-R-Y, Gerstle, G-E-R-S-T-L-E, oneword.com. His Twitter handle is at G-L Gerstle. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. That's all one word. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly announcement by email, that tells you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually at 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast at Apple Podcasts and most major podcast sites, and you'll find years of podcasts at those sites or at my site. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Greg Boyle, George Packer. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos of Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you to Gary Gerstle. Thank you, and keep up your good work.
Thank you, Terrence. It's been a pleasure.
Very much so.
I'm Desi Doyen from BradBlog.com.
And I'm Brad Friedman, also from BradBlog.com.
You're listening to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
CD quality audio, fewer commercials.
And all your favorite progressive shows.
Like Hartman, Miller, Malloy.
And more.
And instead of local commercials, you hear great features.
Like the Brad Blog's Green News Report.
That is great. No local radio affiliate, no prob. We're mobile.
We are where you are.
So while you're visiting BradBlog.com,
don't forget to listen to Progressive Voices.
And don't forget to spread the word.
Thanks for listening to the Progressive Voices Network, streaming the best in progressive talk 24/7. Keep the progressive conversation going on by joining our community. Each week, we send out an email that covers important things taking place in the Progressive Voices Network and throughout the progressive world. Be the first to know of upcoming shows, schedule changes, exclusive programming, and more. Simply go to progressivevoices.com and sign up for our mailing list. It's that easy. Progressivevoices.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for joining the Progressive Voices community.